KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Sweets are not just candy. They're also an important cultural signifier. Julia Harrison has been exploring the history of sweets in Washington history. Julia Harrison is an anthropologist, an artist, and a scholar of sweets. 4 years ago, she began the Sweet Travel blog when she went on an 85-day sweets safari to Japan. She now has got some 300 entries that you can check out there. She's currently creating an online multimedia map of bakeries, desserts, and candy makers around Puget Sound. She's going to curate a 2013 exhibition for the Wing Luke Museum on Asian sweets in the Northwest. And Julia is one of Umani Washington's scholars. She's touring the state with a program called A World of Sweets in Washington, revealing what our sweets say about our shared history and our culture. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here with you.
It's kind of hard to imagine today when everywhere you go, you're surrounded by sugar and sweets, but they used to be very hard to come by, and they had a certain significance in culture, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sweet flavors are one of the things that is a liking for sweet flavors is sort of programmed into people, and part of that was that sweet flavors in our early evolutionary days indicated that a food was safe to eat and a good source of energy, but those sweet flavors were so scarce that for most of human history, gathering in them enough of them to eat was actually a net loss in calories. So going after something like fruit or honey was a pretty big drain on your resources. So the big change came with the introduction of sugarcane, which spread from Papua New Guinea around the world and the kind of rolling waves of technology, and especially the introduction of slave labor in growing and processing sugarcane. And that meant that sugar was available, first of all, to the very wealthy, for whom sugar was basically a medicine or a spice. So it would have been sprinkled on even kind of meat dishes in medieval Europe. Yeah, it sounds, some of the recipes sound a little horrible. And then when things became more widely available, the way that you could kind of show off your power was by having really elaborate marzipan or sugar centerpieces. There's some wonderful stories about wealthy people who would have these kind of like huge centerpieces with maybe a stag made out of sugar. And then in a certain point in the banquet, someone would shoot the stag and a like dessert wine would come pouring out of the wound in its breast. So it's it's hard to imagine things like that now being on everybody's tables, but even things like the cakes that we eat at Christmas, like fruit cakes or spice cakes, those are leftovers from those days when sugar was considered a spice and was a way of celebrating or saying like these people are important and worthy.
And a little bit closer to home, you found that it was sugar that brought many Latin Americans to the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, that's true. One of the first waves of migration was, first of all, to the Rockies, but it was for the harvesting of sugar beets. We are in a part of the country that does not support sugar cane at all, so we didn't really see those waves of migration. But during World War II, there was a bumper crop of sugar beets, and there was a labor shortage, so there weren't enough local laborers to harvest them. And there was a special arrangement between the Mexican government and the U.S. government to bring in guest workers to harvest those. And a lot of people ended up staying and moving towards this part of the country and being sort of experts in that sugar beet harvesting field.
You have documented that we have sweets from more than 40 countries and cultures here in the Puget Sound area. What are some of the more unusual ones that you might not think of? And also, maybe you could talk a little bit about how they differ one to the other.
Sure. Well, one of the great examples of a place where I got to sample a bunch of things at one time was the recent Viking Days celebration up at the Nordic Heritage Museum. And they set up these sort of, they're called hearths, but they're basically just, you know, tents where they sell different foods from different countries. And one of the cakes that I was really delighted to get to try was a special Icelandic torte that is, I can't pronounce the name properly, so I'm not even going to try on that one, but it's layer upon layer of a cardamom-flavored shortbread, and cardamom is a really popular flavor in the northern European countries, and they would slice it up and layer it with a spiced prune jam, and then I think some of the recipes call for it to be weighted, but in any case, you leave it for several days, so the whole thing kind of compresses and all the flavors infused together. And then you would slice off very thin pieces of that. So that was the Icelandic table. And then the Danish hearth, you got to try æbleskiver, which are those little spherical kind of donuts. And one of the wonderful things about going to that event is you actually get to watch the line of volunteers making them. And you gain, you know, in the 15 minutes or so that it takes to get to the front of the line, you gain a huge amount of respect for the skill involved in making a perfectly spherical donut out of batter and a weird little frying pan. It's almost like a magical operation.
Julia Harrison is sharing some of her presentation, A World of Sweets in Washington, where she talks about the role of sweets in world history and what they say about us. Maybe you've got a question about it. It's 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869. You can write to us, conversation at KUOW.org. Maybe you'd like to talk about some special sweets that you have found. It's toll-free 800-289-5869. So one of the really interesting things that you're doing is you're studying how bakeries and sweet foods kind of connect us all. And one of the things that you've uncovered is that they were Japanese confectioners here way back in the 1920s, but not a Chinese bakery until 1979. Now, both ethnic groups were here. What's that say about what was going on?
I think that's one of the most moving stories of the sweets that I've discovered here that really talks about the lived experience of historical events. So there was actually a Japanese bakery here as early as 1900. It was called Sagamiya, and it was downtown on 5th and Jackson. They won an award for their mochi, which is a kind of dough made out of pounded sweet rice, at the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition. So they were doing pretty well. And they had a thriving business and also several competitors up through the 1920s. Then the Chinese thing is completely different. And I think that that has to do with Chinese migrants. When they came here, they were laborers, and they were working in kind of horrible, heavy industry situations. They were mostly male, and they did pretty well for themselves. And so very early on, people started to get a little bit nervous. And in the 1880s, they passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. And what that did was say that no new Chinese laborers were allowed into the country. And then when the Japanese were kind of in a similar situation, the difference was that they were allowed to bring their families over. So if they were already established here, there were, you know, lots of Japanese men working in the same kind of industries, but they could save their money, buy land, and bring their families. And so they were able to really continue a lot of their traditions in a way that the Chinese migrants weren't able to. So by the 19 teens, in this area, there were 26 Chinese men for every single Chinese woman. So that gives you an idea of what a skewed society it was. And so things that were a part of family life and celebrations, really, there just wasn't enough of a critical mass to support a commercial baker. And then obviously the tables kind of turned in World War II. And when the Japanese were incarcerated in the internment camps, about a year and a half later, the Chinese Exclusion Act was reversed. And so Chinese families began to have more of a base here in this area. Sagamiya ended up being returning to business after the war, although they had been looted. They closed finally in 1978, and in 1979, the first Chinese bakery was opened. So there was this real kind of flip-flop between those two cultures. And the first Chinese bakery in our area was Monhei. It's still open, and it's a really wonderful place to go. And one of the things that's really significant about them is they serve mooncakes year-round.
What's a mooncake?
A mooncake is an incredibly heavy pastry that usually has a salted egg yolk in the center of it, surrounded by either lotus bean paste or red bean paste, and then wrapped in a larded dough that's pressed into a mold to give it a beautiful shape with some sort of symbolic significance. And they're eaten by families and friends together during the Moon Festival, and they're really important in Chinese cultures around the world. And those are usually only made and eaten at that time of year. But Monhei's first baker, who is the father of the woman who runs the company now, he decided that because people here were so hungry for that taste of home and their history, that he would offer it all year round. So for a long time, that was the only fresh mooncake that people could get, and they would line up around the block to get it all the time.
Now, are the types of sweets from culture to culture so distinctive that someone who's maybe not you, who's probably tasted all of them, could taste them and go, oh, this is definitely a different culture of sweets than this sweet, which is from somewhere else. What do you think?
I think absolutely. Just to mention a couple of things that I've already briefly touched on, the flavor of cardamom is incredibly significant and popular in Northern European countries. Marzipan, slightly south of there. Marzipan was a paste that's made out of almonds and sugar that probably originally started in the area that's now Iran and spread northward from there and was so popular that it's now basically, a staple of most German and Northern European pastries. And then rice-based sweets. I recently had the opportunity to meet with a group of people from a variety of different Asian countries, and we were looking for similarities and differences between their sweets traditions. And that idea of the pounded rice as a basis for sweets was almost universal in the different Asian cultures. And they had different meanings, but that idea of taking the individual grains and making them into one cohesive mass is about concentrating the power, the life force of the rice. And then that in turn is very significant for using those sweets in celebrations.
Now, some of these ethnic sweets like mochi has kind of broken out of its individual cultural group that it came from. But are there still a lot of sweets that kind of reside with Japanese Americans or with Scandinavians that don't really get out there very far?
I would say that there are some things that people are still a little squeamish about if they're not part of the tradition that they grew up with. One of my absolute favorite sweets ingredients that I'm from the South originally. We have a plant there that's called kudzu that most people are not particularly fond of. And one of my favorite types of Japanese sweets is actually made with kudzu. They go out and harvest it in the winters. It's indigenous to the country, so they've kind of had more time to figure out ways of using it. And they go out and harvest it in the winter, reduce it to a powdered starch, and then in the summer, they use it to make these clear, glassy, gelatinous noodles that you eat in iced molasses syrup. So when it's 1,000 degrees and 100% humidity, that is one of the most refreshing things that you can eat. But I know that even in the Deep South, that idea, refreshing as it is in the summer, might seem a little bit anathema to people.
Julia Harrison, you mentioned at the very beginning that it was the taste of sweetness that told people this is something safe and good to eat. Well, we've come a long way since then. Sweets have a kind of a bad reputation. They've been tied to childhood obesity. In New York City, they tried to ban the Big Gulp because there was too much sugar there. Do we have an unhealthy kind of connection to sweets at this point, do you think?
I think absolutely we do. Yeah. We have an unhealthy connection with so many things in our lives that started out a long time ago being a treat. One of the best stories that I've read about this recently is there's a wonderful book by a Portland pediatrician named Jan Chosen Bays, who wrote a book called Mindful Eating based on her Buddhist practice. And one of the things that she talks about is that when she was a child, she had a really horrible illness. And after she would go through these treatments, her parents would take her to the ice cream store and she would get a scoop of ice cream. And that was her reward for patients going through her treatments. And she talks about now that she's an adult, she is surrounded by ice cream. I mean, she can walk out her door, she could call a delivery service, she could have 1,000 flavors and 100 pints delivered to her door almost instantaneously. But she has chosen to say no to that. And so she still reserves that particular treat for times when she needs that sweetness, she needs that support, she needs that memory of her parents. So by being really conscious of the power that that sweet has for her, she retains it kind of in her emotional arsenal. Mm-hmm. So it keeps that potential for comfort. I think that a lot of people, if they look back in their stories of sweet consumption from their childhood, have things like that that they could get back to and that they could use in both a kind of dietitian sense of health, but also in an emotionally healthy sense. And that's what I try to encourage with this idea of talking to people about sweets in a way that's not just about this is good, this is bad, this is this is delicious, but talking to them about the stories behind them and about the work that went into making them and about the ingredients and the path that those ingredients took. I think, the healthy relationship starts with getting to know these things better again.
You know, in our culture, there seems to be high sweet culture and low sweet culture. I mean, I can go down to the drugstore and pick up a Hershey bar. I would call that my kind of low sweet culture. Or you could go to a fancy schmancy place like Theo's and buy sort of Kraft chocolates. Do you see that kind of high-low culture split when it comes to sweets in other cultures too?
Absolutely. And I'll go back to this idea of Japan because that's the culture where I've done most of my my work. I mean, the high end there are sweets called kyogashi. We do actually here have a very wonderful opportunity to have kyogashi. There's a woman named Tokara over in Finney Ridge. So these are basically like hand-wrought sweets. So she's making everything from scratch and then sculpting them into these amazing shapes. Her offerings change every month, and they have poetic names, symbolic meanings, and they're all about trying to kind of get you to be conscious in the present moment. They have a really wonderful effect. And then on the other hand, there are stuff called dagashi. These are cheap sweets that were basically enjoyed by children and kind of started in the Edo period, the Victorian era of Japan, when these ingredients started to become cheaper and more widely available. And these would be things like Rice Krispie treats, but pressed into a shape of a religious hero. There's a lot of sense of humor mm-hmm. in them. And those were sweets that were also made to last a little bit longer because they were sold from stalls. And so they started using, kind of fake dyes and things like that. So yeah, that division is pretty strong. And I think it's not just high-low. It's often associated children and adults.
Oh, sure. Well, our palates change.
Absolutely.
And we need more intense things as we get older.
Yeah. And, the kind of flip side of that, though, too, is that for those of us who do remember a time when sugar and sweet flavors weren't quite so prevalent, that it's not about the flavor needing to be intense. It's about the impact of the flavor being intense. So Tokara, again, she told me that when she makes sweets for groups of people, she asks what the age of the consumer is going to be. And so if it's for an older group of people, they need that sweet flavor to get the feeling mm-hmm. from it. So she amps up the flavor. For younger consumers, she actually dials it down because we are so inundated by the sweet flavors that kind of that mildness, it's not just that we can perceive it better, but it actually has more significance if it's less sweet.
Julia Harrison, my guest, you can check out her sweet travel blog. There's tons of different sweets there, and they're beautiful to look at as well as to taste. You're also working on this multimedia map of sweets, candy makers, bakeries, desserts around the Puget Sound. How's that coming?
It's coming very, very slowly, but yeah, very well. There are now, it's called Sweet Map, and the address is sweetmap.info, and the first 10 interviews are in place. What I wanted to do with this was kind of recreate the wonderful experiences that I have had. When I travel places, I tend to just go around either with a piece of paper, like on a list of sweets that I want to try, or with very rudimentary phrases, asking people, what is your favorite sweet? What is the special sweet of this area? And the responses that I get to that are kind of overwhelming. I've had people take me by the hand and lead me places. I've had people tell me stories about their families or about the country that they originally came from. So Sweet Map is my effort to introduce people, to take people by the hand and show them the stories behind these products.
And you can go on Julia Harrison's Sweet Safari by checking out those websites. They're all at kuow.org. Also, Humanities Washington has a program that she's doing called A World of Sweets. And if you go to the website of Humanities Washington, you can see where she's going to be appearing next. Julia Harrison, thank you so much for telling us about sweets.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix, and we get production help from Molly Williams and Cameron Drews. Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.